The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Hello?
Can you do we need the mic? Or?
Can you hear us all right if we just talk at normal level?
Okay.
All right, let's just I don't like mics.
Yeah,
I got a big voice. This room's funny. God, you're all the way back here, and then y'all are all the way there. I'm going to move up to that table.
Yeah, why don't we?
Do you mind? I mean, it's easier for you to hear us.
Yeah,
I'd like to see you, and away we go.
Conversation.
Yeah, we want to have a little more of a dialogue than just talk at you. I mean,
I don't know if we're going to get any more people, but we might as well get started. I'm supposed to do a discussion on regional trading agreements. That's what this particular workshops, huh? And we thought we'd tell you a little bit about ourselves first, so you know who you're talking to or who's talking at you and why we should be here talking about it. And then actually poll you all, find out what do you want to know, what do you want to hear about? Because, you know, I can talk about 100 different things about regional trade agreements and 95 of them you don't want to hear, so why waste our time? So that's kind of how I want to, we've agreed we'd approach this thing. So I'll start. I'm Jim Holbein. I've been an adjunct professor here at Washington College of Law for almost 15
since
years.
Since 93.
Since 93, so 12 years. Gary Carpentier is my co-teacher. Right now he and I are teaching a class negotiating regional trade agreements. It's the first time we put that on. Dean Grossman and Danny Bradlow and I have worked closely to set up the new specialization on NAFTA free trade agreements and regional trading arrangements. And so the idea being that we see that as a growing trend. And we've got some papers, if somebody wants them, there's a couple free copies I have here of a WTO paper, The Changing Landscape of Regional Trade Agreements. I sent it to Dean in your materials. I don't know if it made it in. If it didn't, there's some copies here. And basically it shows that there are hundreds of them. There, every country in the world of Mongolia is involved in a free trade agreement of some sort, or a regional agreement. Prior to, or during this time while teaching, I've been publishing a legal series on NAFTA since the same time, actually 92. And that's a seven, just became an eight volume set. I believe it's here in the library. It's in most law libraries at universities. So that's kind of the market for that series. The idea being that it's the most comprehensive set on NAFTA, as well as other free trade agreements, because we're bringing in all the U.S. Signed free trade agreements as part of our series. We focus on dispute settlements and commentaries, the text of the agreements, and try to give some background on that. I ran the NAFTA Secretariat at the Commerce Department for 10 years. It was both the FTA and NAFTA Secretariat, which manages the dispute settlement provisions of the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement and then NAFTA. So I have some familiarity with both negotiating agreements. I helped to negotiate the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement and implementing agreements because of my management of the dispute settlement portion of it. Now I've had other stuff before that, but that's not particularly relevant to this topic. Currently, I have my own consulting company, Global Trade Consulting LLC, and I work with startup companies with, besides publishing and teaching, we have a few other things in the corporate sector, more working in corporate investing and helping to grow small companies into large companies. That's kind of the focus I've done recently. That's kind of it for me.
Let's go ahead.
Okay. My name is Dante Figueroa. I'm the Latino right here in the town. I'm originally from Chile, and bear with my accent, so after a few words here, we'll use my accent. I graduated from law school in 1993, so Professor Palmer was my professor when I came to the U.S. to get my LLM, so I feel a lot of reverence to me and I learned a lot of materials concerning the settlement in international investment disputes. I'm originally from Chile. I have a learned degrees from the University of Chile, from the Washington College of Law. I'm part in New York and here in D.C. and I didn't adjoin at the our law school based at UCL for a year and a half, teaching international business transactions in Latin America. As you can see, Latin America has 34 countries. I'm supposed to be an expert in every single country. I know you have never seen that.
It's
a tough call. But anyway, no, I try to link two worlds, two legal systems, the common law and the civil law, running away a civil law system, and local parties, for example. So I just give the publicity. If you want to join the class, it's going to be offered next semester for the third time. And you can see the review of other students and the syllabus available. And I publish in Spanish two books and a number of articles. And now my first law review article will be published next month in the American Law Review. Everything is related with Latin America. That's kind of an interesting book. And now I'm doing consulting work in transactional work related to Latin America. And what else? I'm very happy to be here. I'm not an expert in international trade, I should say. But I kind of understand the business of it. Before coming here, I said I'm going to focus on six topics, which is, as Jim said before, could help in framing our discussion.
Well, Gary and I will also be teaching a course next semester. We just signed on, since you mentioned that you'll be teaching. We'll also be teaching one on regional trade agreements and focusing on the dispute settlement aspect. So we'll have a lot of NAFTA. We'll talk about other country systems, other agreements, and we'll do, as we're doing this semester, simulations as well, so we can get some interactive experience with things, which is, it's always fun. Students like that because they don't have to just listen to those yammer after you actually get to participate. And those are fun. We've done them before actually. They work pretty well. Okay. Well, why don't we poll you guys? What do you want to, can we just start with you? What kind of brought you here? What are you interested in hearing about?
I think my interest is a little bit about the connection between trade agreements and human rights. What experience you've had as far as where this is going to go.
Well, actually, I'm from Catholic University and I'm here at the Boston Association. And we're having a panel on NAFTA and CAFTA next month. Exploring the impact on societies in Latin American countries from these treaties.
Sure. If you want to get information from either of us after the thing you sent out, we'd be pleased to help you with that.
I have a document that kind of makes available for you that is called, it's one that I wasn't prepared. It's called CAFTA Trade and Commercial Law and Institutional Reform Assessment. A synthesis report for the CAFTA countries. So you might be interested to get on that. I don't have a copy of this outline, but I have it available.
Yeah, we can email stuff from this one, so I know. Depending on how much you want. I guess I can give you enough to make it, a wheelbarrow or a little less, depending on how much, do it a long time, so there you go.
Okay. I'm also interested in
learning about
CAFTA.
About CAFTA?
Hi, my name is Ruth Mosambiero, and I'm also interested in human rights aspects of it, but also how the political atmosphere in Latin America, particularly South America, that is changing right now, how that is affecting trade agreements and what seems to be the road ahead, and opportunities are there.
I'm Chris Williams. I'm also a first-year student at WCL. We just started the International Trade Law Society this year, and we are having the CAFTA panel, and you guys are welcome to come here in the area on November 1st at noon, I think it's upstairs on the 6th floor. And ours is dealing with CAFTA and the labor rights, and we're going to integrate that in with the textile agreements that are still, I think, under negotiation. But out of my actual personal interest, I want to do trade and development working in Latin America, specifically any type of economic development work. And also, I was wondering if you guys' opinions on this is more of a theoretical topic, but between regional and multilateral agreements, like what is more effective? Do smaller countries have a little more power when they negotiate with like more like countries that are stronger, like Brazil, where you've seen Brazil and the FTA agreements really help strengthen some of these interests that the United States avoids in the WTO, and this Doha kind of a lot of these development issues are really, it's really taken a long time for them to anyone to even back down in the process.
Specifically, kind of what happens when you get in a situation where there's such a kind of disparate negotiating power between a lot of the countries that engage in international trade after the treaty is ratified, and specifically governments like some of the Central American governments that, the threat of lawsuits and international arbitration, especially given the figures that some of these countries put on them. Because they're trying to find leverage over these governments and the way they structure their environmental laws, labor laws, things like this, which some of you mentioned. So I guess it sounds to me, just listening to everyone, I was like, well, this was sort of, some of the dangers of the externalities of these agreements. And also, to the extent that you have any tips on how to take some of these small trade companies and make them large trade companies.
Okay.
That might not be appropriate, but I guess advice on it.
The small to large dynamic that some of y'all are hitting on is one of the things that's kind of near and dear to my heart in a way. I always emphasize that in my classes because it's such a, it's an important issue. It's a really important issue that is not insoluble, but it takes a lot of creativity. And you guys, one of the points I like to make in my classes is it's your group that's going to solve some of these problems because it's going to take a whole generation to really come up with good solutions. So if you start work on it now, you may see the fruits of your work in 15 years. You may take less, but it may not. So those are some things where you gotta kind of think about that. So I welcome a dialogue on that. And that's kind of what I'd like to do with this. I'm hoping that we're establishing a dialogue in class as opposed to just in the seminar or this workshop. So it's more like a seminar as opposed to just us talking at you. What you got, Mike?
I am very interested in just give us a quick overview on trends and in regional trade agreements, and I know that overall I think that tariffs have been going further and further down, and kind of just when teachers are going, they're increasing in what effect they're having on tariffs and things like that, and then just like everyone else, kind of enforceability issues, especially bargaining power type things, and maybe if you can analogize or differentiate between the trade agreement negotiation process and contracting, so you just kind of give an analogy, because I think it would really help some of us who have less experience in international trade or in trade agreements that are going on. And then maybe if you can also give kind of a quick overview of the effect of other treaties or customary international law and kind of the effect of that on regional trade agreements. I'm also very interested in the human rights aspect and how it's affecting society, citizens, those societies that are in these agreements as well. If you can hit all that.
What's your sir?
If you could sort of touch on the EU, success and failure there, whether that's
EU.
Yeah. And whether that could be a workable model in this part of the world or perhaps Asia, you see that sort of coming into fruition.
That's a good question. Because it really is something fairly foreign for North American students or even Western Hemisphere students to get into. I'll confess my lack of depth in my knowledge of that, because like you, I haven't studied it much because it's not available to study very much here. It's a good question, though, and we'll try to get on it a little bit. Those of you who walked in late, what we've been trying to do, we introduced ourselves, and we felt that rather than just lecturing you or talking from some kind of set script, that we'd go around the room and ask what everybody wanted to hear about. So that's what we've been doing, and established a dialogue that way. So we talk about what you're interested in, and not
the 95% of the stuff that you're not interested in. So why don't you let us know?
Well, I don't know what's already been said, so.
It's all right. Just what do you want to hear? That's what I want to know.
What do I want to hear? As she mentioned,
human rights.
Human rights.
Human rights. A lot of your interest. Okay. What about you?
I'm actually interested in learning about how these regional trade agreements affect labor rights.
Labor rights.
And whether or not there's ever, I'm not very familiar with regional trade agreements, but if there's been an effort to try to impose certain kinds of standards by, you know, some region of the U.S. to try to impose it in other countries.
There's an interesting dynamic.
And how successful that has been.
I think we can do that.
This one.
Sure.
You want to?
Yes. We've been asking everybody what, this is the workshop on regional agreements, and rather than just waste everybody's time, we kind of wanted to hear what you want to know about, what are you interested in. So if you have a topic that you'd like us to touch on, everybody else has given their opinion, and please feel free. Just let us know.
Okay. My name is Emma
Salazar.
I'm from the University of Washington.
Oh, wow.
I love international law, and I have kind of a problem because in Seattle you're constricted to the region where trade agreements are the relevancy, for example, of Asia versus Latin America.
Sure.
And I was wondering if you could speak a little about perhaps the possibility of overcoming that geographical location, because without being willing to move to a specific region where, you know, Latin America, for example, is Southwest or in the East. So just working in your region, but trying to reach further from your geographical constrictions, especially the interests that are in that region. If that made any sense.
That's a topic, but we'll see if we can tackle that. I think Dante may be able to give us some advice because he's a consultant on Latin American affairs. Why don't we just go along with you?
Okay,
come back and forth. I don't know that there's a particular order, but I think you're right.
RTS and JAL.
Yeah, why don't we start there?
Okay.
You want me?
No, please.
Okay. Regional trade agreements. The impetus, the reason that regional trade agreements have become important has more to do with the multilateral trading system than it does with anything else. The background in it is, and I'll try to keep this short, but it's hard because of the complexity of international trade law. The GATT was created in 1947 as the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. A lot of you know this, but some of you don't. So, and that's what the initials, that's why the acronym GATT. Okay, the GATT was supposed to be implemented as by an institution, the International Trade Organization, the ITO. The U.S. Congress saw fit to refuse, the U.S. Senate refused to ratify the Havana Charter in 1948, and therefore there was never an ITO created. So the GATT was hobbled. It was an exercise. It was supposed to be a three-legged stool of institutions created at the Bretton Woods Conference. Two of those were extraordinarily successful, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And the idea was that the World Bank's original name was the IBRD, the International Board for Reconstruction and Development. And the idea was we're going to help rebuild Germany and Europe and also Japan, and kind of like really thought of in that fashion. And the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, was to help fund that effort at rebuilding, because they wanted Europe to get back online, back into the world economy, and begin growth. It worked, and the 50s were a time of enormous growth and stability. The GATT was the tariff-cutting exercise, because the background on it is, real quick, the U.S. implemented the Tariff Act of 1930, the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, where Congress went absolutely crazy and erected tariff barriers on everything that was worth trading, and the rest of the world retaliated. These huge trade barriers around the world prevented trade from going anywhere, which was the bigger contributor to the Great Depression than the actual stock market collapse that everybody attributed to the Great Collapse in 1929. It wasn't that, it was the Smoot-Hawley tariffs in 1930 is what killed the world economy and led to World War II.
And there was a consensus that we have to do something about it. So the three-legged stool, IMF, World Bank, and the GATT was a tariff-cutting exercise. And for the first 20 years, it was all about cutting tariffs. Then it became the GATT Secretariat. Over time, that administrative body became an institution de facto. Whether it was de jure, of course not. And it was always a provisional agreement. Everybody could enforce it, but they didn't have to. It was never really binding. It became the WTO, and that's now a much more binding and much more established organization, much better way to govern multilateral international trade. Under the agreement, Article 24 allows better than MFN. There's some particular clauses that are requirements of the GATT agreement. One is MFN, most favored nation treatment. The deal you give to one nation, you give to everybody. And the other, non-discrimination. When goods are moved into your trade in your country, foreign goods are not discriminated against vis-a-vis domestic goods. They're treated the same. Okay? National treatment is an aspect of non-discrimination. So those principles were kind of the guiding principles. All right? Article 24 allowed you to give better than MFN treatment, preferential treatment, in special circumstances. The two really are customs unions and free trade agreements. Okay? Customs unions are effectively a group of countries that get together, cut tariffs among them, and other trade barriers as well, but tariffs is the primary goal, and have a common external tariff. That's the EU. It was originally the European Community, and it started as the common market, all about that common external tariff. The FTA model is a different one. You have all the countries agree to go to zero on tariffs among them, but they maintain their own tariff system. So anything coming from other countries than their trading partners is charged whatever rate that they want to charge, which is the NAFTA model. With that, you need a really strong rules of origin. And if you look at NAFTA, the rules of origin are just incredible. Really, really tough. Okay, so that's where this RTA, the Regional Trading Agreement, that's the basic background legally of how they came about. Were it not for Article 24 of GATT, it wouldn't exist. Okay. That pretty much tell you enough on that. All right, seeing the nods, I'll move on. What's happened is, over the past 50 years, regional agreements were not particularly favored. The European Community was the one that was really the successful one. And everybody was around the world, while on the one hand afraid that the Europeans were going to become too powerful economically, they were a counterbalance to American economic power, the first. Second, it was a way to prevent them from going to war with each other. If they become integrated as an economic group of countries and they have a lot of cross-border economic interest and free movement of labor, etc., it makes it a lot harder for them to go back to war. And since all of the wars in the 20th century started in Europe, that's probably a pretty good idea. So politically, it made a lot of sense to let them organize that way. They went ahead. Did so, it was successful. The U.S. did only one free trade agreement before the really 80s, and that was with Israel, which was totally political. It showed to the rest of the Arab world that we're supporting Israel, period, full stop. We're their guys. And it was a demonstration politically of the U.S. intent to do, to support them. Okay. The next agreement the United States didn't do. Jump in any.
No.
I'm used to this. I talk. Not a problem. The next example was the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement. I was fortunate enough to be working in the State Department when that agreement was negotiated. And so I was on the negotiating team. I actually had a position because the Deputy Assistant Secretary who I was working with was assigned to be the Chief Negotiator for the State Department on the Core Group of Chief Negotiators. He would never go to the meetings because he had another group of investing issues and there was a huge set of issues he had to deal with, and he wasn't doing that particular agreement very much. Two or three of us junior people were able to sit in for him at all the meetings, so I went to all the meetings of the core group of chief negotiators, and got to see what was going on. Occasionally had to actually sit at the table with all these other very senior people and represent the safety firm. It was hilarious. But it was great training. No, I mean, it was great. I learned a lot. And the chief negotiator, Peter Murphy, was really a mentor to me. And he's one of the few guys I can point to in my career who was really helped to guide me. So it was really a wonderful experience for me. I enjoyed that because there was a very collegial atmosphere between us and the Canadians. And there was a common goal. What was the goal? It was being negotiated at the same time as the Uruguay round in the GATT. And the reason that we went bilateral is it was a decision in the administration, or Republican administration, that the Uruguay round was stalling over agricultural issues, among others. There were three or four others. Okay, and I could give a whole lecture on all this, and I don't want to do that to you. But the basic thrust of this is Uruguay round is stalled. We need to demonstrate to the world that, you know, if we don't go, actually it wasn't stalled, it wasn't getting going. So we actually initiated it at the same time. That's the actual better way to say it, I'm sorry. Because we initiated the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement to show the Europeans that if we don't go into the Uruguay round, the U.S. will go bilateral. So we initiated the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Talks. They didn't like that a bit, so they went ahead then, and that's how the Uruguay round got started. When it stalled in the late 80s, early 90s, then the U.S. said, okay, let's show them that we can do a developing country. Let's bring Mexico into the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement, and that became NAFTA. Both were successful efforts, and both were intended to move forward on the multilateral front. So this answers someone I said about multilateralism versus regionalism. The U.S. policy has been somewhat successful, I think, that used regionalism to help move forward on the multilateral front, show the way to the other countries. And I think in both the U.S.-Canada agreement and in NAFTA, the U.S. was able to show that. The more recent agreements are somewhat different than that, but they're also somewhat related to the Doha round and attempts to show that the U.S. can broaden. If we can't do something in the multilateral arena, we're going to do something preferential with the rest of the world and start going that route. And some are more successful than others, some are bigger than others. But that's an important goal. Okay, so why don't you want to kick in?
Two comments about CAFTA, right, which are just general. The first is, it seems that there's the current paradigm of free trade market is
one.
Has this meaning in history. Nobody, for whatever reason, nobody's proposing an alternative system that can be shown or be proven to be successful in the world. And that's basically after the end of the Cold War. Everybody is dancing the same dance. So everybody, all the countries in the world, and we have China now talking the free trade market language, which was, how many years ago, it was unthinkable of.
Well, Tiananmen was in 1989. It was pretty unthinkable then, so not that long ago.
So everybody's talking or the same talk and dancing the same dance so far. And for the reasons maybe are different, and I'm going to make a comment with respect to the Latin American region. Some of the free trade market proponents might be absolutely convinced that it's the best system to basically organize the economies, the world economies. Some of them may be supporting free trade economy in general because of the lack of creativity. Because of the lack of alternatives. And thirdly, I would say some of them may be supporting free trade economies because they just happen to be there. They don't have the energy to make different proposals, as everything in life. So for whatever reason, the free market model is here and it seems to be here to stay for a while. We don't know how long, but this is there's an apparent irreversibility of the system. Apparent, I would say. And now I'm going to tackle with the issue of Latin America. Latin America is not a region where free market free market model has been praised, embraced, or even successful thoroughly. So we are talking, but even though that's the reality, I'm not going to go into history, and we have one example, and maybe two very close, that not everybody agrees in that the free market model is the way to go. But it still is there, and everybody's talking the same talk. This is the political, the philosophical reflection, if you wish. But now, with respect to the more legally, the legal aspect, this philosophy of the free trade model, Jim talks about the WTO and all the GATT-related agreements, separations, and meetings, and multilateral free trade agreements themselves, customs unions, and bilateral free trade agreements. So in the Latin American region, we see that there are multilateral regional free trade agreements. It sounds like a contradiction, but multilateral RTAs and bilateral free trade agreements. So this is, seems to be like a race for making true in every single Latin American system that the free trade model is implemented at the national level. So that's the first reflection. The reflection is that it's the free market model has come, it's here to stay. We don't know for how long it will stay, but my caution, and this is kind of taking a foresight, is not everybody understands the concept of the free trade model in the same way. So, and the lack, and this is a philosophical point, when everybody talks the same talk but understands something different, the consequences can be seen in the near or the long term. So that's the reflection. My second point, just after this, is that from the viewpoint of the WTO and WTO-related agreements, the RTAs, regional trade agreements, are definitively, I would say, illegal, but go against the primary purpose of the WTO, period.
That's right.
Why? Because, as you said, the most favored nation provision, what you give to a neighbor, if you are in Guatemala, what you give to Honduras, you have to give to Mexico. The way you treat Colombia, if you are Ecuador, you have to treat Peru. Is in Article 1st, any privilege, right, or concession provided to a third country has to be immediately and unconditionally granted to all the other members. So what is this? That RTAs are meant that one country member gives more benefits to other members without extending or granting the same benefits to third parties. And then there's an exception in the WTO and the GATT agreement. Can you explain?
Well, there's some rules on it. In particular, agreements, RTAs have to cover substantially all trade among the participants, and they have to be effectively trade neutral against everybody else. They can't be trade diverting, but they have to be trade enhancing among the members, but not leave everyone else in any worse position than they were before the agreement.
Okay.
The rule as to how it's to be applied. In fact, it doesn't work that way, and everybody knows it. And that's why there is a real tension between, I totally agree with Dante's comment, that's that tension that he was alluding to.
Yeah, I'm going to refer to this tension, because on the one hand, we understand that most countries in the world are parties to the WTO, so everybody is dancing the same dance. But some of them decided not to go on the unilateral approach, but to go on the bilateral approach, as you explained with the case of the U.S. and Canada and Mexico and the U.S., Costa Rica, and then this whole bilateral agreement. So the issue here and the question that I want to pose to all of you is, and also give my opinion, is that there's a race for trade liberalization as a level inferior to the as compared to the multilateral level. So countries who, for whatever reason, are not ready or willing to join the or to implement all the all the measures that are contemplated in WTO, for example, in the case of agriculture or professional services, where not every country, we know, for example, you mentioned Brazil. Brazil is not willing to make concessions in the agricultural area, and neither is the U.S. on the other hand. So they decide, these countries have decided to enter into bilateral agreements. So the question is, how can we find, the question is, are compatible with WTO obligations that are acquired by the country members with those the obligations that are acquired at the bilateral level? And my speculation, this is an open question, it hasn't been solved. I understand the WTO or the
Council of Ministers,
and RIA also. And my guess, and this I'm going to leave it for open for comments, is that we are going to see during the next years, maybe not many improvements or advancement at the multilateral level, but we're going to see a multiplication of RTAs or bilateral trade agreements, and in say just in a few words, everybody's going to get there. They are meaning the free trade, but through different ways. And that's the way I see it. And there are many problems, as I say, the inconsistencies, overlappings between multilateral and
Now, I think we can turn at that. Now we kind of set the stage, give you a little background. And I think there's kind of three categories of questions that you all pose. One involves like human rights, labor rights, those kind of specific things that are not really trade and how do they overlap. Textiles is in there, and I'll kind of hit that, but not really. The second group is about the really it boils down to the small country or small corporation, the small-large dynamic. How does one deal with that? And it's a really critical issue, I think, for the long run. It's really important. The third is EU and trends, kind of what's going on, and I think I can hit the EU in there. And I'm not sure I can solve the niche problem. Yes, sir.
If you could address the question I've had about regional trade agreements and subsidies and how they're justified and excused, especially for agriculture.
Subsidies in agriculture and RTAs?
Yes.
That's what we want to unfold our question, please. Subsidies and RTAs. I may not get them all, but we're going to get pretty close.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Just add to that, along the same lines, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, the Latin American problem really is the U.S. calls towards agriculture and the restrictive tariffs and all of that. It's probably maybe a more philosophical question, but address how the Group of 22 and Brazil and Argentina as leaders, what can they really do to counteract what the U.S. needs to do about them?
Well, I'm not sure I agree with that perception right now. And it's been true, but I would say last week there was a big change, and that was that the U.S. made a new proposal on agriculture that moved off their existing position substantially. And if you looked at the post just 2 days ago, I emailed this to some colleagues, actually. And in fact, I sent it around to my class, because we're teaching one on negotiating free trade agreements, a regional trade agreement. Now, the EU has agreed to move, but has not agreed to move. They're offering 8% would be left out. The U.S. is offering, along with Japan and the G22, the G10, any number, the Cairns Group, all agreed to only 1.5% of agriculture would be left out of the cuts. And the EU is stuck at 8%. So now they're the bad guys. They're really the recalcitrant guys, and it's still the French farmers. The French farmers are holding the whole world hostage because they refuse to give up their subsidy. And now those issues are completely intertwined. And until the Europeans have enough backbone to stand up to the French farmers, they're not going to be able to deal with it. And frankly, if they stand up to the French farmers, the French government will fall. And if the French government falls,
then what happens? They don't know. That uncertainty, that political uncertainty, is really hard for them to deal with, because they're really afraid they're going to get a new government in France that will not support freer trade, and they'll become more difficult, not less difficult, to deal with. So this stuff is big power politics, heavy-duty interest groups who have a lot of political and economic clout. I mean, that's why it's fun for me to study it, because it's about money and politics at the global level. It's big stuff. So that answers that question in a short way, and not to be glib, but look at it, because the new proposals really are much more forward-looking. So I think the U.S. is going to be able to wear the white hat for a little while. Let me tell you, this administration needs to wear the white hat on something. A friend of mine, oh, this is aside, this is too funny. A friend of mine said to type in failure into Google and then hit I'm feeling lucky, and it came up with the George Bush White House website. I almost died. I couldn't believe it, because he's been hit so hard on it recently. That's what comes up as the most, but recently his big tag is hilarious. So he definitely, I mean, poor guy needs to wear the white hat on something. So that's why we do it. Now, not to,
yeah,
what do you want to do?
Yeah,
do you want to approach it kind of those? How do you want to handle those groups? What issues?
Yeah, I think we should move on to the questions that they posed.
Yeah,
as a result,
that's what I said.
I think we should talk about the two issues here. CAFTA was mentioned more than once, and human rights.
Sure.
Because that's something
that's
an issue.
And we can kind of group labor rights in that too.
Okay, labor rights, yeah, absolutely. Let me say just a few words about CAFTA. As you all know, CAFTA was a Central America Free Trade Agreement was passed by the U.S. Congress in a month ago. Two votes in the Senate, so it was very close call. And I just want to refer to the mechanics of the Free Trade Agreement, of the CAFTA. What is for? Why was the Free Trade Agreement with these four countries necessary at all? And what is CAFTA mean to achieve in the future? Why just not bilateral agreements? And in that sense, the CAFTA is meant to liberalize trade, and liberalize trade explained in just few words means, it has been said already, but to remove tariffs and non-tariff barriers to trade, to international trade, as we're saying. So in that sense, I have two comments. The first is that the most basic form of trade is trade in products, in goods, in things that we can touch, in moving cars, exporting agricultural products, bringing in computers to the country, selling oil, selling steel, rice, bananas. That's the quintessential concept of trade. Goods that move from one country to another, from one jurisdiction to another. So that we know that that goods can move from one country to another in ways, in two different ways, as exports and imports. CAFTA, with respect to the trade in goods and with respect to the imports of this good, is relevant because it eliminates the tariff barriers to the importation of U.S. products into CAFTA countries. In other words, if, let's say, computers, Apple computers that were sent and sold to Costa Rica at a tariff 15%, after CAFTA is passed, and I'm not going to talk specifically, I don't know if there's phase out tariffs.
They're staging, but it's not.
Staging.
I think it's a 10-year staging.
10-year, okay. But at the end of the phase out period, there's going to be zero tariffs. So if the computer was worth $1,000 in the U.S. and the Apple wanted to sell that computer in Costa Rica, has to pay 15% more.
So at
1150. So at the end of the phase-out period, that Apple computer is going to be sold in Costa Rica for $1,000. Period. That's the traditional, quintessential point of what a free trade agreement aim at, to reduce tariffs. But not only tariff barriers, but also non-tariff barriers. And you know about that, about quotas,
about other limitations to trade that are not necessarily expressed in money, in taxes, but in recognized and fighting phytosanitary restrictions and the like, depending on the area. So that's with respect to goods. And that's with respect to the one specific area of the trading goods, which is imports of U.S. goods into Central American countries. On the other way around, exports that that's a quid pro quo. So it means that CAFTA products will enjoy the same benefits. And that's what countries bargain for when they send it to the U.S. Now, my opinion about this is that CAFTA will benefit American companies who export their products to CAFTA countries, and as a consequence, those products will be sold in the local markets at lower price, and people will have more accessibility to these goods, and there's a lot of other consequences. But with respect to other way around, even though the treaty, the CAFTA, aims at liberalizing the trade with respect to CAFTA products coming to the U.S., CAFTA products will face other type of restrictions in the U.S. And those restrictions will not be imposed by the government. In other words, the U.S. government will not be establishing a special tax for under CAFTA, legally at least,
right.
Legally for bananas. So the this administration of the next will not approve legislation or regulation raising the tax for bananas coming from CAFTA countries on 50%. That would be illegal under the treaty. But the limitation of the problem that these CAFTA products will face, and this is, again, I'm trying to speculate in what is happening in the future, is that CAFTA products will not be able to meet the standards that are required by the U.S. by U.S. customers. So it's going to be a different type of barrier, which is going to be imposed by the market itself, by the invisible hand, in the way I put it, not by the governments. So in other words, the U.S. government is not going to say, in my opinion.
For example, if a banana grower uses DDT, which is fairly prevalent in the rest of the world, but not in the U.S., totally illegal in the U.S., if there's a little bit of DDT in their pesticide for the banana growers, and that DDT residue is over more than one in a million part on the bananas that are shipped into the U.S., they can be barred because they do not meet our standards for food safety. And so as a health exception, they're not allowed in. And that's exactly the kind of barrier you're talking about. Otherwise, go ahead.
So what happens to the, I mean, isn't there already that market of importation, for example, of bananas?
Yeah.
And the smart growers who already know that are the big growers like United Foods, you know, or Del Monte. They already own huge banana plantations down there. What you're doing is helping the U.S. corporations that already have huge holdings. They're the ones who can ship. It makes it easier for them. This answers a little bit. It's a beginning to touch, because I want to touch on the small country and the human rights issue in a bit.
Yeah, just CAFTA. The second leg of my comment with respect to CAFTA as an it's with respect to foreign direct investment. I'm referring to U.S. investment in CAFTA countries. CAFTA countries are, you know what those are? Guatemala, Honduras, Costa Rica, El Salvador, plus Dominican Republic.
And
we are
Nicaragua, but not Panama. And the DR has joined as well.
Okay, so the issue So the issue with foreign direct investment and CAFTA is that all those barriers that exist in CAFTA countries or before CAFTA enters into force, will have to be removed by CAFTA countries in order to ease foreign direct investment. And that is going to be problematic. It's going to be problematic. And let me give you just one example why it's going to be problematic. And this is more related to what I do, very specific or case oriented. For example, one element that foreign investors take into consideration before making an investment in a developing country is, among others, tax issues, you know, but labor issues. How can I hire and fire local workers? That's an essential element. And for them, it's for multinational companies or for investors in general, it's not an issue about human rights. It's not even an issue about labor rights. It's an issue about cost. In other words, US companies are familiar, and their counsel, are familiar with the rule of employment at will. You know what employment at will means? The freedom to hire and fire the workers, which is the US rule in general terms. So that mentality, so that when they go to Costa Rica or Nicaragua, they want to know what are the rules. So if I make an investment, say the US companies, I'm going to make an investment in Nicaragua, I want to know whether I'm going to give severance payments to the workers 1 month every year they have worked for me for the last 5 years. What are the causes of, that I
vacation,
can I do vacation?
What are the benefits?
It's a big cost. Big cost. Just think about maquila industry. So labor issues. I want you to get this clear. It's not about for investors. It's not about human rights. It's not. Maybe I'm being too, very blatant here. It's
tell
not about a free trade. It's about cost. What is the cost? Tell me the bottom line. How much? I'm going to finish that. I'm going to leave that. So the example of what I wanted to give is, think in the context of CAFTA. According to Costa Rican law, Costa Rican employers can fire their workers arguing four causes. One is if the employee commits a crime against the employer. Second, in the case of grave or serious causes. What are those? Open. Third, and two more I cannot remember in specific, but very, very strict. Four causes. And all of them have to be sanctioned by a judge. In other words, remember, foreign investors with the employment at will mentality go to Costa Rica and find themselves that they are hiring, and we're talking about big money here, 200, 1,000, 5,000 employees.
Walmart comes in, puts in a big box.
Think about that.
They're going to hire a bunch of people.
So the payroll is kind of
McDonald's.
They're thinking, so my prices are going to go up. I'm going to have to charge more for that computer, whatever I'm using. Okay, so I'm going to know how I can fire them. And so I have to sue the employee or ask the judge for a parent, basically, a legal parent to fire the worker before I do that. Okay, you know what? The news is in the Dominican Republic is even more restrictive than that. There are two causes. Crime against the employer, another serious or grave.
Can fire a thief for murder.
Okay.
Or, somebody who assaults you.
So, anyway, those are the rules. So, and CAFTA is supposed to eliminate barriers to trade. So, the question is, do all these different regulations in CAFTA countries constitute barriers to trade? Or they just are the rules by which both foreign and domestic investors have to abide? In other words, can we argue, and then I'm going to finish now and go to your question. Can we argue that the legal systems themselves may constitute a barrier to trade even though free trade agreements are complied with formally?
Mm-hmm.
The legal system itself. And then I think the next step to that is to say that what necessarily has to come is harmonization of the legal system. So let's say Costa Rica and Dominican Republic and Nicaragua will have four of the same causes. And we're not saying what those would be. It would be up to them to negotiate. And this would be beyond the free trade agreement. Harmonization. What are the reasons why a Nicaraguan worker, for example, should have more protection than a Costa Rican worker? Don't they work the same hours? Don't they want the same things for their own lives? Don't they want to feed their own families, send their children to school, and pay for a house? So what is the difference? So this is more philosophical again, but the legal issue is there. So you can comply formally with CAFTA, but you're going to find that the legal system itself may constitute a barrier to trade because it doesn't change. CAFTA, Fitarian, don't...
I kind of have an argument slash question that comes right off of all that is when, I don't know, when we talk about trade agreements, like you're saying cost is one of the major factors and businesses are the ones that are the heaviest lobbying groups. I know labor plays some sort of role. Consumers play no role because of the collective actions of consumers in general. But my biggest like pet peeve is a lot of the way that trade agreements go is they're very one-sided, and we don't look at aspects that are why free trade is supposed to. I mean, my background is international economics, and one of the premises, the foundations you have to have in a free trade agreement is what the EU has. You have to have free movement of labor. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the reasons why you have these labor rights problems in this country with a lot of the migrant farmer workers, that if they were brought into the actual formal economy, you wouldn't have a lot of these labor rights violations. And why aren't those things included? I mean, I can understand there's a lot of xenophobia that's why they aren't included in our legislation with like NAFTA, other things, but, and Europe's having their own problems, but doesn't it, if these countries kind of just jump in right now in these agreements, wouldn't it be better for them to join amongst each other, and then when they have more bargaining power to get the United States, I don't know, that's what I've always, that's a big battle.
Okay, now, before I answer that, because I want to answer that, and I want to get into some more, that leads into some of your questions. Technically, this session ends now. We're at 4:45, okay? There is a wrap-up session between 4:45 and 5:30, okay? If you want to go, by all means, y'all can get up and go anytime. You're free always to do that. I'm willing to stick around and talk for a while because I find, if you're interested, I'm very happy to talk about this. And so, it's totally up to you if you want to stick around because I'd like to get into some of these issues and continue because it's hard to do it in an hour. This is complicated stuff, and you've laid the groundwork, and so it's up to you. All right? With that caveat, now you're all staying now of your own free will. You're not forcing you. So there you go. Now we've done our disclaimer. Okay. Now, a couple things. First off, the difficulty of and this is the small country, large country dynamic, small corporation, large corporation dynamic. I really want to talk about that before, and then I also want to talk about human rights, labor rights, and trade agreements. Because small countries have a big problem. Half the countries had a big problem in that their economies are not well diversified, okay? And they're competing against each other from the get-go on the same agricultural products, on the same, basic minerals and goods and, raw materials. Their base of manufacturing is extraordinarily similar. And so they don't have economies of scale, they don't have real competition on enough areas, and they don't have yet the basis on which to spread different types of manufacturing and different types of service provision among them so that you have, El Salvador becomes the producer of automobile wheels, and Nicaragua becomes the producer of assemblies for various types, and Honduras becomes the expert in electronic components, et cetera, et cetera. One of the benefits of CAFTA should be that over time, larger corporations will come in, invest, and that will naturally lead to world-class investment and world-class plants, as far as on the good side. It will also lead to better insurance, better banking, better services provision across the board throughout the CAFTA region. And you get more division among them and separation so the market becomes closer to one market rather than five markets. And that's been their problem on labor policy and a lot of other issues, and why they've had so much difficulty in coming to grips with free movement of labor, et cetera. Now, that's one aspect of it, and that's a small, large issue. When you're a small country, it's very hard, and you're very distrustful of other small countries, and you're terrified of, I mean, the United States, my goodness, the production in one day equals your entire economy for the whole year, you know, so it's scary. If Walmart comes into, you know, Costa Rica, San Salvador, okay, and they put in a big box there and two or three big box store, I mean, by that I mean one of their typical stores you see all around the area. Okay, they come in with a big box store, what that has the effect of doing is providing all of the goods in one location that a typical downtown of even a moderate-sized city would provide at all of the stores along the main drag. And so they absolutely, you know, put a stake in the heart of the downtown areas of most medium-sized communities. So they're great, because you can find anything you want. Everybody goes to Walmart, but it kills the downtown, unless it's done wisely. And the problem, the real problem is the mom-and-pop store on the corner where you go to get your milk and light bulbs and a bag of rice or whatever it is, your staples, okay, they usually will survive a free trade agreement. Not too hard, okay, because it's just, they're there, they're traditional, a little higher price, but the convenience, they're your cousin, they're your friends, they know. So those kind of folks stay in, the real small people, the small traditional markets tend to not be affected. But you go to the established stores where you maybe have three or four branches in a number of cities, and then you get a, say it's a jewelry store with three or four stores around in one of the countries, say El Salvador, you get a big jewelry conglomerate coming in, and it can outcompete them on price like crazy, then they're going to have a very hard time surviving. What happens? They get acquired. Now it's 4-0. Does that make a difference? Maybe yes, maybe no. They keep the employees and keep the stores open. That helps. But the profits don't necessarily stay in the country for reinvestment. They go back out. So there's some real issues. They're not all resolved. They're not. It's not always to everybody's benefit. If the profits are coming out, then that's not available to reinvest. On the other hand, if they keep the stores open and keep everybody employed, there's that helps. If they expand and the international conglomerate comes in and instead of four jewelry stores, you have 20, one could really argue that that's been a very big net benefit for El Salvador, even though it's 4-0. Because now you got 20 stores, you got all those people employed, they're making better wages, and they're putting it into the economy, and that's a better thing. It's a way to develop on a rational basis. If they close them all, and then only brand their own, then it's a different thing. So, don't know. And those are part of the adjustment issues, and it isn't always black and white as to what happens. It's really shades of gray as to how's it going to go. But that's the big and small country part of the dynamic. Another aspect of it is smaller countries and social policy, which is what we're overlapping when you have what do you do about health policy, about your labor policies, about other issues that are typically viewed as human rights. If those are harmonized, then it would be like in the United States, flip it on the other way. The big, just the fear, the huge drumbeat we heard is that if we do these agreements with other, these less developed countries, our environmental laws are going to be watered down. And we're going to, you know, be just, it'll be way to our detriment. That didn't happen. Okay? But when the bigger country comes in, if the smaller country's social policies are changed and watered down, they have the same, absolutely the same political problem, the same fears. They do not want a worse society. They do not want a society that's less protected, has less, you know, insurance or health insurance or benefits in any way, shape, or form. And that's a real problem for them, because if it adds enough cost, then the investment doesn't come in. And these agreements, while they cover trade and services, are fundamentally about where does the investment flow. Where does the money go? Follow the money. Where is the money going to go? CAFTA was signed so that they would get more capital from North America into that region. That is what it's about. Sorry, guys, but it's that simple. It isn't a whole lot harder than that. And what happens then to social issues on that? If the companies that are coming in and saying, we're going to put $40 million store in, and there is nobody else going to do that. We're going to put in a $40 million chain of stores in your country, but you really need to change your labor laws to make it a little easier for us to get rid of some of the employees, or we're going to go to your neighbor. Now what does the legislature do? What do you do? How do you respond to that? And they do that. I mean, international companies are able to make that kind of pitch. You have a question?
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, that you're kind of talking about the race to the bottom effect, you know, everyone fighting to get this, you know,
the threat
corner. Isn't that true that there's a whole other threat that also has the effect of watering down a lot of these laws, which is the threat of a lawsuit and international arbitration? And the examples that you provided so far, particularly about Costa Rica, kind of fit the Harkin Energy case to a T, which I'm sure you're familiar with from 1998, when, you know, the company spent $17 million on oil exploration to do a study. Mm-hmm. And when the government, Costa Rica, which is one of the most environmentally protected countries in the world, we're not going to let you do it, then they sued him for $57 billion in, you know, international arbitration. The only way Costa Rica was really able to save itself was by not committing to it, saying, no, if you want to do that, you got to come to our courts and we'll take care of it. Obviously, you have a chance of winning in the first place. Capped by that, they wouldn't be able to make that choice. And so, you know, the threat, it seems like, is almost worse than the opportunity it costs of not getting that direct investment, because that's multiples of their GDP. You know, to lose that in one lawsuit, yeah, you know, it's just destroyed. So even just the risk of going to international arbitration and risking losing that kind of...
I know we both want to say something about that, because that's a really good question. It's an important question.
Actually, two questions. You have two questions. First is about environmental and labor standards, whether there's a race to the bottom or whether countries can keep their own levels of protection. And the second question is about arbitration. So which one do you want to address?
Which one do you want to do?
The first.
Then I'd rather that works perfect. I'd rather do the arbitration.
Okay. That you mentioned that there is competition between countries, developing countries, to attract foreign investment. And one of the ways to add value to their competition, their size, is by basically promising the developed countries not to incorporate higher levels of protection in their national systems. In other words, that's what I see instead. I mean, there are two things. One is in the legal field, another is what happens in reality, or the factual, what happens in reality, as I said. First, I do not see, and to the best of my knowledge, correct me if I'm wrong, that most RCAs, in general, free trade agreements, provide for that the country, signatory countries, have to lower their labor and environmental standards.
That's political suicide. They do not say that because they cannot.
Okay, so what you said, what you mentioned, is not in the legal field. In other words, all free trade agreements provide that the signatory countries, in this case we're talking about developing countries, will enforce their current environmental and labor laws.
And those laws, as they have changed, even if improved.
Even if, of
they're,
course,
they're allowed to do that.
For example, even an example that is found in both the Chile U.S. and the Chile Canada free trade agreements, they have environmental side agreements. Well, actually, the Chile U.S. free trade agreement doesn't have an environmental side agreement.
It's only in the text.
Unlike the U.S. Canada free trade agreement, it has an environmental side agreement. And in the case of the U.S. Costa Rica free trade agreement, I understand that that's the same case, that the environmental provisions are inserted in the FTA itself. But in those cases, there are two provisions that are relevant to this discussion. The first, that the countries commit themselves to enforce their existing laws and regulations, and those to come. First, enforce. So we come to, somebody mentioned the issue of enforcement of the laws in Latin America. And the second obligation is that the countries, the parties, let's read in this case Chile, a developing country, commits itself to maintain high standards of environmental and labor protection. So that's two-pronged a commitment that the country, the developing country, undertakes. But the issue, that's the legal, in the legal field, but de facto is what Jim said. Countries do not enforce their laws. They basically, they tell, and this is by experience, the Minister of Labor, let's say of country X, meets with the Chief Operating Officer of Apple that were here in Tegucigalpa in El Salvador, and they meet, and the representative, the foreign investors, tells the minister, Mr. Minister, we have found out that your laws have only, labor laws allow for just two causes for foreign workers, and this is very expensive for us, you have to understand, because that will increase our payroll, or twofold, thrice. With respect to environmental provisions, we have seen, for example, the case of the tire manufacturing company, representative for any of the tire manufacturing companies, talks to the Minister for the Environment or to the Energy Minister and says, Mr. Minister, we have to realize that the air regulations, or therefore or air pollution regulations, are similar, as has been the case, as those that exist in Switzerland. Can you explain to me? We understand that the per capita is different between those countries. So can you explain a little bit more to me? And then after that conversation, the minister talks to the government, basically goes to talk to the Congress. The message is passed to Congress, and then action is taken in Congress on
or not,
and the other, the easier way, the most frequent, two more ways. The second is to amend the regulations. Either the Minister for Labor just passes a new regulation, or the Minister for Environment passes a new regulation, instead of saying 10% or 5 grams of arsenic per liter of water, they said, Okay, well, okay, so this tire manufacturing company cut its part its business, and this 5 to 10% has huge impact because of the cost of the sewage treatment plants or the anyway. So the thing is,
you can use filters as opposed to an entire new plant of sedimentation and lots of other stuff.
That's
so
that's very expensive.
The difference.
So that's still, we're still in the legal field. Legal field at international level, where the country, the treaties say, legal field about what the national laws say, but there's a third element, which is the fact, is when the government looks to the other side, labor laws, and that's the real world. The laws are there. Everybody, if you compare, for example, I don't want to mention countries, I don't want to offend anybody, the laws, for whatever reason, labor law, the employment law, the laws, the working protection laws in countries south to the border of the U.S., and compare them with the, I said south, I didn't say what country, with those, most with the most protected state and federal laws in the U.S., they're going to find that the balance is just absolutely this way. More labor protection down the south. But really, so workers should be better off there. Should be much better off. Isn't that what the law says? And isn't that what NAFTA says? That you have to enforce your
labor
law?
And you can be sued if you fail.
If you fail to sue them? Really? So what's the problem? What's the matter here? They have better laws, and they are bound and obligated to enforce them. So what's the problem? Where is the, something is just not, not fitting into it. It's a disconnect. And that disconnect is explained by what you said. There, the governments look to the side because they voluntarily do it because of pressures. So this is the way the real world works.
They look at the benefits and the costs, and they say, look, yes, we're not enforcing our labor rights, but we've got a whole lot more people employed, we've got a lot less problems, there's really more immigration, we have more money circulating in the economy because we have so many people employed.
neighborhood. We've got a lot more housing. There are a lot more stores that can be supported because so many people are employed. So we're just, we'll try to keep it from being too egregious. We don't want, you know, beatings. We don't want really bad stuff, which is minor stuff to let go. On the arbitration front, the issue is how much incentive do governments give to a potential investor coming in, and how much do they commit on the word of the government to an investment? And if they, the more they commit, the more likely that if it's then the, there's a no at whatever level, then they could be sued in international arbitration. If the, it's really is a give and take between the corporation and the government. On the most of their arbitrations, if you really look at the Chapter 11 cases in NAFTA, if you look at the ICSID cases, what's going on is a taking by the government because they fail to let the investor get the advantage of the investment that they've made. If they come in on the front end to the case that you suggested in Costa Rica and said no, there's no recourse, there's no suit, there's no nothing, there's no effect to that. But if they commit $15 million into an operation that's going to go forward. This is the metal plant case in Mexico is another perfect example of that under NAFTA, where they committed and they built a landfill that was the most environmentally advanced landfill in the country, period. It was going to be a really good landfill, but they never really consulted with the local people and they failed to get one local permit. But the feds kept saying all along, no problem, no problem, no problem. At the state level, no problem, no problem. And the lawyers for metal plant said, well, geez, we're still missing that local permit. You know, we need that. No problem, no problem, no problem. So they go in and they invested $17 or $18 million. And then the local community first called it declared it a turtle. An environmental, it's like a park, but a preservation zone for the turtles. And then when that was, it was a land tortoise. And then when that was started to go rogue, then they nationalized, it became a park. And so that landfill never opened. Metal plant sued and won, and what they got back was effectively the amount of their investment. Okay, not this huge damages and treble damages and this, you know, they could have sued for $150 billion, and they did. They sued for a huge amount. They got back what they invested plus interest. That's what they got. That was the real value of their loss. So, and that's what the arbitration panel saw. So, and that's the most celebrated loss against Mexico in the whole time, in the whole NAFTA thing. There's huge literature now, or not huge, but a big literature on Chapter 11. And the fears that people have about international arbitration, they aren't being realized if you really look at the cases. The cases are about unfairness, undue, you know, invitations. I'm using the wrong wording, I'm sorry, because it's not coming to me.
No, but
on medication.
No, but
true.
Not all arbitrations are lost by the countries.
No, most are won.
Most are won.
Most are won.
So the devil's in the details.
Yeah.
Of course, I mean, there's a bit against the Chilean government.
I agree with you in respect to value.
No, I really
low. Sorry, the number's that high. You know,
but the number that you're suing for isn't the deal. The deal is what is the result, okay? That's what you really are looking at. I recommend strongly that you go to NAFTALaw.com or to the ICSID site and take a look at the cases, and you'll be stunned. I mean, really. Most of them are won by the governments, and the actual awards are small. They're not. They're based on the value of the investment plus interest, maybe a little bit on top of that, not much.
There is one case against the Chilean government for $500 million, and everybody knows that it's not going to be like more than $20 million. Everybody knows.
Look that up.
Yeah, I think
we should probably wrap up. There's one, talk about trends.
No, there's one specific question that I want to address, because it's very simple. I think the answer is short. If are these treaties, I think the lady over there asked the question, meaning to RTAs, customary international law?
Yes.
You pose that question?
Right.
Why do you pose that question?
Why?
Yeah. What is behind your question? What?
Well, I just feel like customary international, the way that it's formed, and it's not very, I mean, it's not a solid body of law, and also enforcement is, you know, week.
Well, let me ask you again. Yeah. If the answer were yes, they are customary international law, what consequences would there be? Because you, if you ask the question, whether there must be a difference if you answer yes or no. So what would you envision would be the question? Or is just a purely academic question?
Well, no, not purely economic.
Academic.
I guess I'm interested in your opinion on if, I mean, treaties are one way of forming customary international law. I mean, clearly multilateral treaties would be more effective than just a bilateral treaty because more countries would be involved. But maybe if, I guess I'm just more interested in knowing, because I don't have an extensive background on this, if what the effect of these agreements that are increasing is having on customary international law, if it's forming more customary international law, or if there's a background in customary international law that maybe is affecting the negotiation and the formation of these agreements. And, you know, kind of
I asked you because I have been teaching international law for a number of years, and customary international law, you know, that must be, it's a very professorial.
Well, I'm glad you're handling that.
Practice, yeah, continuous practice of specific behavior for a certain number of years. Second, the psychological element, the subjective element, with the intent to. Or with the conviction that that rule or that behavior is required by law. Okay, so in those two conditions are met, that custom becomes the law. And that is a source of international law as stated in the statute of the International Court of Justice, like Article 18. Okay, good, thank you. The reason is, and the relevance of the question is, and I understand, I mean, I think I'm trying to grasp what is behind your question is, because if all these treaties, and there are so many, are creating customary international law, therefore, those countries who are not a party to these treaties would be bound, even though they have not signed. Or even if they have signed those treaties, they have not ratified them. Or even if they have signed them, ratified them, but they are done that with reservations. And there are many out there. And the question is, if that's the case, why? What happens in general international law, for example, in the law, international law for expropriation, which is absolutely related to arbitration, if that's the case, why not to expand or apply the same rule to the field of trade law, international trade law, WTO law in general, or FTAs? Therefore, if that were the case, if the rule were the same in general international law and in international trade law, we will solve a lot of problems. Let me give you an example. Cuba would be bound by some of the international or customary trade laws that were created. And this is my, and you can take my name, this is my personal answer. There's no way that international trade rules are will become customary international law. Period. Boom. Why not? Because you're touching the pockets of the countries, and skill, type of skill, are negotiated one by one, syllable, there, letter by letter, every point of the percentage by
that versus which.
That way. So when, let's say, if it were still in Latin America, when the U.S. provides that apparel, textile from CAFTA countries will enjoy a 1% discount, let's say, between 2006 and 2007, it's given 1% discount to products that, according to the rules of origin, applicable rules of origin, come from CAFTA countries to CAFTA countries, big money here. They're not saying that because CASTA happens, let's say this hypothesis has a free trade agreement with India or China, the products from India re-exported to or China to CASTA countries would enjoy 1%. Ah, because it's customary law. Or Mercosur countries. No, it's a 1% percent CASTA countries. 2006, 2007. So this is my opinion. Period. No. This is very strict law.
Big interest. I don't know if you agree with
that's
that approach.
For you want a question?
Yeah, I just want to comment on that. I think insofar as interaction among the different countries in their execution of agreements, contracts, because, you know, that's what treaties are, contracts. There is a creation of customary law, but it is not in the substantive aspect of that contract that is entered into agreement, but it is in the principles underlining that that agreement. So, for example, some contract principles, as we know it from common law, would come into play.
Give an example.
For example, intent. You know, you need intent, or you need consent to have a contract, and you need you need to have certain actions happen before you can alter, you can change a treaty. That's same across the board. Tends to be the same unless you enter something different in the contract that says, you know, changing this treaty can be done by XYZ, but
it's only neutrality.
But you refer, usually you tend to grab on to underlying principles of contract. Now, it's really different, civil law, common law, and some contract principles do line up, but others don't at all. But in general, I think that's where her question
you missed it, but that was another part of my question was, contract terms and kind of how that...
And insofar as that is involved, there are...
Yeah, I mean, that's a big question. I don't think we have time or because we're going to go to trends, but the itch is interesting. Because
you can email us on that.
We need to wrap up at this stage. We've answered, I think, most of the questions. We didn't get to you on EU, right?
Or what were you going to...
Quick insights on EU. I think EU has bitten off as much as they can chew for a while. They have a very ambitious program for expansion. The big deal with the EU, the reason that a lot of other countries are not following their model, is not only do they allow the free movement of goods, services, labor, but there are enormous wealth transfers between the main members and the new members. And so they really invest a huge amount of money into the infrastructure of the incoming countries. And the United States will never do that. Foreign aid is such, it's almost as bad as being called a liberal. Soon almost as bad as being called a conservative, the way things are going.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so tarred as being the incarnation of evil in this country that it's going to take a long time to overcome that. And it's wrong, but it's just what's happened. It was easy to do politically, and now it's become too true. And so foreign, you have to rename it. That's why they've had to rename some things like... NTR, the normal trade relations, used to be called I can't even remember what the one was before. But anyway, it was another term for a long time. It's probably drugs. I'm losing words today because I had back surgery, so I'm on some drugs. I can't quite think of everything. But anyway, point is, on the EU, they're not going to expand that model beyond. It's a very, very tough model if you don't have a richer, poorer country to go with. Mercosur tried to do it, and they're having a tough time. Mm-hmm. Can't do it in Asia. Asia's having a heck of a time. They, with both ASEAN, was the intention to build something here, but they had no rich country to fund it all. Mm-hmm. Then they tried to go to the Asian Free Trade Area, and they're still not able to pull it together. Mm-hmm. And unless China joins, and then it'll overwhelm them, and they're scared to death, China will do anything. They're just like, oh my goodness, the end of the world's on us if the China economy really gets going and pumps in. They're going to just become another provinces of China, not through war, but through the economics, through the markets. They'll just own them. And so there's a real, real fear there.
Yeah.
they're more afraid of them than they were of the Japanese, because, you know, traditionally the Japanese are the guys who fear an Asian, now it's the Chinese. And so that's why I don't think it can be done in the Middle East. They don't have broad enough economies. It's never going to be done in Africa, I'm sorry to say, because they can't get it together. Mercosur is trying it, in Latin America, and there's no other region where it's going to work. In the former Soviet Union, it's just not going to happen that way. They won't unite that way. There's too many politically, and just there's too much bad blood. There's too much, literally, we're ready to go to war with each other in Azerbaijan and, Chechnya and other places for them to become a counterpart. I don't see how that'll happen. So that kind of leads nowhere else for it to happen. So there we go. Can I do trends for a minute?
Yes.
1 minute on trends. What do I see in trends? I think there's going to be a slowdown for a while. I think there's been such a rush to free trade agreements and regional trade agreements that right now, Mexico, for example, has stopped doing it because there are enough disparities among their 34 countries that they do trade with. They have one with the EU, they have agreements with every country in Latin America, they have several in Asia. And what's happening is Chile has the same problem. And we did a program about this about 6 months ago, and the people from both Chile and Mexico were saying there are enough differences among these agreements where we actually really complicated our customs tariff schedule, because we have to have so many columns for each good has a different schedule for each agreement. And so now what we were trying to do is simplify, and instead we've just incredibly complicated everything. At the end of the day, 10 years from now, it'll get to zero with so many countries, it'll be great. But in the meantime, we're just, yikes, how are we going to do this? And they're having to go back and renegotiate with substantial numbers of their trading partners to harmonize the tariffs alone. So I think there's a slowdown. U.S. policy is such that I think this administration will not initiate talks with any new partners from now on. I don't think they will. The cap to fight, that was it. You know, there's the U.S.-Australia one, and one with Morocco, one with Bahrain, and there's a few other ongoing talks. But they're not going to initiate anything else. I think they've had it. They really have. They're really, the only thing Bob Portman wants to do, as far as I can tell, is make the EU move on agriculture and let's get the Donau Round up. And that will be the legacy for this administration. So I don't think we're going to have a move forward in the U.S. policy on RTAs until the next administration at the earliest. I think Europe is too consumed with their own deal with trying to expand. That expansion effort is enormous. I think Africa is trying their darndest to go. They have a lot of agreements, but they can't get their act together. They're having just incredible difficulty because of the poverty level, the lack of infrastructure, the inability. They just don't have enough capital flowing in the entire continent to do things that must be done in order to be not just competitive, but feed their people and provide clean water. And, you know, they haven't got the basics of survival down yet. So once they get that down, then they can turn their attention elsewhere. I think the Latin Americans are doing a pretty good job of coming around. I think the politics work kind of against merging, but I think slowly but surely they're merging. And I would propose to you in 10 to 15 years, you will probably see a regional economic bloc of some sort that encompasses all of Latin America, or at least all of South America. And it will take at least that long, but I think they're going to get there. Because the Andeans and the Southern Cone, I think pretty soon they're going to work it out, and they will see their benefit of having freer movement of goods. So they're going to be one of the first. I think the Asians, particularly South Asia, they're moving toward it as well, and so you'll continue to see movement to improve the regional arrangements there, because there are real good reasons to do it, but it's hard. It's a really hard thing to do politically and economically. It's really hard to succeed at different regional agreements. Is that solid for everybody? Yeah. Thank you very much.